Here we go, 6:13, Tuesday morning, October 22nd. The cool weather we had last week was a little unseasonable, so we're back more to the regular seasonable stuff. Bone dry, highs in 80, 82 range until next Wednesday, and that's what we got. So there you go. No real cold weather coming in, as far as I understand, from Chris Franklin, WWL chief meteorologist. And he also said that he was officially declaring a hurricane season over, that we're done, which means I'm going to Home Depot later on and get some plywood. Just kidding. Howard Gleckman joins us now, the senior fellow in the Tax Policy Center, to talk about the tax plans of both Kamala Harris and Donald Trump. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Morning, Tommy. How are you doing?
I'm okay. You know, I was asking people before we came on, really, while we're going to have a serious conversation here, and we need to give the context. All of this depends on Congress and so forth, but I wonder if people are voting on personality or policy. Is there any research as to that, or do you know, Howard?
So I think that Trump voters are largely voting on personality. Mm-hmm. They love Donald Trump. Doesn't really matter what policies he espouses. The Harris people, I think, also are to some degree voting on personality. They're voting on Trump's personality.
Anti, right?
Right, that's right. This election more than anything else is really about Donald Trump. Do you want Donald Trump to be president or not? You know, Harris is a much smaller personality, and it sort of shows in the campaign. You know, we'll see whether or not her policy proposals, which are really quite extensive. You know, it's interesting. For a long time, she's been criticized for having no policy. She's actually proposed a lot of stuff. We'll see whether a lot it's caught on, whether voters have paid any attention or whether they like what she has to say. We'll see.
Well, that's the politics part of it. Let's talk the policy part of it. It can be some complicated stuff. So, Howard, I'm just going to stand back, and if I have any questions that I think the audience would have, I'll jump in as you compare and contrast Harris and Trump on their tax policy.
Sure. So they both proposed a lot of stuff. And you know, it's campaign season. That's what you do if you're a politician.
You promise people
stuff, right? And they're both doing it sort of on steroids. More recently, Trump has been doing it more than she has, but they both got a lot of proposals. So to give you some kind of high-level differences between them, Harris is proposing things like extending and expanding the child tax credit, which is for low and moderate income families with kids. She's proposed expanding the earned income tax credit, which is another thing for low and moderate income working families. She's said that she is going to extend the provisions of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, that big 2017 tax bill, but only for people making $400,000 or less. People making more than $400,000 and corporations would pay more in taxes than they do today. So that's basically where Harris is going.
Okay.
Trump is proposing a wide range of very targeted tax breaks for all kinds of people. You know, he said he's going to exempt tip income from tax. Harris followed him in that one. He said he's going to exempt Social Security benefits from tax. The other day he was on the stump and he said he'd consider exempting income earned by first responders, military personnel, and veterans. That's 22 million people. He'd exempt their income from tax. He's also said he's going to cut the corporate tax rate to 20%, maybe to 15% for some corporations. All of that would probably cost $8 or $9 trillion over the next 10 years. It's an amazingly big number. He says he'd pay for it by repealing the energy provisions, the green energy provisions of the Inflation Reduction Act. You know, those are the tax credits for buying electric vehicles, stuff like that. That would save about $700 billion. So that'd get him about 10% of the cost.
$700 billion out of $8 or $9 trillion, or $7 or $8 trillion?
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. Yeah, so it's about 10%. It's less than 10%, covered less than 10% of the cost. The other thing he would do, of course, is he says he's going to increase tariffs. Now, every time he's on the stump, he talks a different number. Sometimes he says he'd increase the tariffs by 10%, sometimes 20%. The other day on the stump, he said 400%, 500%, 1,000%. Doesn't make any difference. So we don't really know exactly what his tariff proposal is, but my colleagues at the Tax Policy Center modeled a proposal that would be a 10% worldwide tariff, a 10% tariff on every product that the United States imports, plus a 60% tariff on Chinese imports. And we estimated that that would raise about $2.8 trillion. So you add the $2.8 trillion and the $700 billion, and you get about $3.5 trillion you're paying for 35 or 40% of what Trump is proposing. The question is, where's the rest of the money going to come from? Mm-hmm. Harris, on the other hand, is proposing probably a net increase in the debt of about $3 or $4 trillion. So it's still a huge amount of money, but compared to Trump, it's pretty modest.
So bottom line, we got Harris at 3 to 4, according to Tax Policy Center. Harris's plans would increase the debt $3 to $4 trillion. Trump, we're at what number?
6 or 7 trillion.
Okay, pretty soon you're talking about real money, huh, Howard?
You're talking about real money, yeah. You know, the interesting thing is, I remember when I was on with you a few weeks ago, we were talking about this, and you asked about the budget deficit. Mm-hmm. And the reality is, nobody cares.
Nope.
You know, no politician is talking about it. The numbers just keep going up and up. And it's an interesting thing because people were so sensitive about interest rates a year or so ago because rates were so high. They were seeing it in car loans. They were seeing it in mortgage loans. And people were freaking out, and they're still mad about it. You know, both of these candidates have this package of proposals that are probably going to make interest rates higher again. Trump higher than Harris, but both of them would probably raise interest rates again. And nobody seems to notice. Everybody says, that's cool, I want to get my tax cut, so I don't really care about the rest of that stuff.
Have you seen, and I don't mean to delve into politics so much here, Howard, because I know you're a tax guy, but have you seen the showering of no taxes on this, no taxes on that from candidates like we have this campaign season? It just seems like crazy. Now you're talking about, what did you say that he said? If you're a public service employee,
if you're a first responder,
no taxes on your income at all.
Right, no taxes on your income at all. Yep, wow. Military personnel and veterans. There's 18 million, 19 million veterans out there, and he'd exempt their income from tax.
Wait, so if you a know, veteran, hang on a second. So he's saying that if a veteran is making $300,000 a year or $400,000 a year and has gone on and gotten their life just zooming, they're not going to pay any taxes? That's what he's saying?
That's what he's saying, yeah. Okay. So you think about a guy like J.D. Vance, who was a veteran, served in the Marines, and then came out of the Marines and went to work for a private equity company. I don't know what he made, but it's, you know, probably north of what you were saying. You know, hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. Trump says, I'm going to exempt that from tax, from income tax. So, I mean, he, you know, we don't know what the proposal is. He just said, yeah, I think about that. Somebody asked him about it. He said, yeah, it sounds like a good idea. So, so you're just getting people throwing around ideas. You know, when I was in high school, which is a long time ago, we used to talk about people running for class president by promising to put Coca-Cola in the water coolers.
Yep.
And that's kind of what they're doing now. They're just promising anything to anybody because they're trying to get votes.
Let me take a break. We'll pick it up when we come back. Talking to Howard Gleckman, senior fellow in the Tax Policy Center, which is odd to me is that normally, you know, people talk about wanting their country back. Some Republicans want their party back because back in the day, Republicans weren't as concerned with social issues as they were with fiscal issues and debt and deficit and government spending and responsible taxation, et cetera. And now you're talking about the Republican candidate promising stuff that would increase the debt $6 to $7 trillion. The Democratic candidate promising stuff that would increase the debt and deficit $3 to $4 trillion. At no point is anybody talking about this mountain that's getting ready to tip over. We're going to reach a tipping point on this. Nobody cares. And there's going to be a day of reckoning. We'll drill down. We come back. 621 traffic now, WWL.
From Acadian Windows and Hurricane Shutters, WWL Traffic Center, I'm Courtney P. Bonnie Carey Spillway, LaPlace to Kenner do have light delay. As you enter the Spillway Bridge, eases pretty quickly. I-10 East Kenner to downtown New Orleans have light congestion around Veterans. Traffic remains clear to downtown from there. I-10 West New Orleans East downtown, a slowdown begins in the Morrison Curve. Very heavy over to the high rise, have a stalled vehicle there. Downtown elevated and the flyover running at speed. Crescent City Connection wide open in both directions. Huey P. Long on the causeway, no delays there. I-55 north and southbound free and clear. No delays on I-12. I-59 is delay free. Traffic is sponsored by Thibodaux Regional Health System.
626, Tommy Tucker, WWL, on this Tuesday morning. Starting off with Howard Gleckman, senior fellow in a Tax Policy Center, comparing and contrasting Harris's and Trump's tax plans. Harris's, they estimate, would cost $3 to $4 trillion. Trump's $6 to $7 trillion. Somebody texted in and said, stop foreign aid. That would balance the budget. Well, let me just give you an idea that in 2023, the United States spent $63 billion on foreign aid. A trillion, just so you know, is $1,000 billion. So there you go. Howard, somebody else texted in about closing the border would save trillions. Your response to that would be what?
So closing the border is going to mean that there are not going to be enough workers to do health care, to do construction, to do restaurants. That's not going to save money. That's going to cost money. That's going to slow the economy, and it's going to end up costing the U.S. economy a lot more money. The other thing is, if you close the border, a lot of those people who cross the border pay into Social Security and Medicare. They never collect. So actually, immigrants make the Social Security system stronger, not weaker. So if what you care about is the U.S. economy, closing the border is not a great idea. Now, making the border rational and not having, you know, hundreds of thousands of people crossing, you know, with no system for figuring out how many should stay here and how many shouldn't, that's a different story. But if what you're talking about is closing the border entirely and talking about what Trump is talking about, which is deporting 20 million people, that's not good for the economy or the budget deficit. That's actually bad.
See, I think, and what happens, Howard, is people throw everything in the same bucket and they don't realize that they got different buckets. So you can have a debate about immigration and border security, but you can't necessarily tie that into the economy and presume that 1 + 1 = 5, right?
No, that's right. That's exactly right. You know, what you were talking about before is really interesting. You know, Republicans before Trump, you know, it was pretty easy to understand what Republican economic policy was. It was low taxes, it was less regulation, it was free trade, and it was actually pro-immigration. You know, now with Trump, all of that is flipped. You know, Trump wants low taxes, but not low tax rates necessarily. He's looking for special interest tax breaks for specific constituencies so he can get elected. He's now against free trade. You know, regulation is interesting. He wants to reduce some regulation. He's going to put Elon Musk in charge of that. But he also wants to increase some regulation. So it's hard to quite understand where Trump fits in the traditional Republican Party, but it's not the kind of Republican I used to know. Harris, on the other hand, is a very kind of standard Democrat. She's sort of, you know, interchangeable with every Democrat over the last 40 years, with maybe the exception of Bill Clinton, who was more moderate. But she's a left-of-center, kind of standard pro-government Democrat.
I don't care who sleeps with who, but I'm looking at this national debt clock at $35 trillion and rapidly increasing. Quick word about tariffs, Howard, if you would. Who pays for tariffs?
American consumers pay for tariffs. End of story. It's not China, it's not foreign governments, it's American consumers. Tariffs are collected by American businesses that import companies, and they pass almost all of it on to their consumers. We have evidence of this. We've seen it when Barack Obama imposed tariffs. We saw it when Trump imposed tariffs in his first term. We've known this for 400 years. When you raise tariffs, consumers pay the tariff. And that's going to, again, increase prices. Doesn't seem like that's something people want.
Thank you, Howard. Appreciate your time, as always. Senior fellow at the Tax Policy Center. We'll talk with Ted Ross when we come back. Bank rate senior industry analyst. 83% of holiday travelers changing plans because of inflation. What about you? 504-260-1870. Has inflation caused you to change your holiday travel plans? I never go anywhere, so it doesn't really bother me. WWL First News Time, 6:30. 6:45, quarter till 7, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking Ted Rossman, our friend, Bankrate Senior Industry Analyst. 6:45, quarter till 7. Tell me what good morning, Ted, first of all, and welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Tell me what you found about, what Bankrate has found about holiday travel and inflation.
83% of holiday travelers are making adjustments because of inflation. People are doing things like traveling for fewer days, picking cheaper accommodations, and driving instead of flying. In other words, they still want to go on the trip, but they're cutting corners to save money.
Have you seen the movie Four Christmases?
Yes, I have.
So I'm just wondering, as I saw this story, I was wondering about travel. Is it travel to vacation destinations? Is it travel to over the woods and through the hills and all that crap to grandma's house?
It's all the above. I would theorize that a lot of it is the classic home for the holidays. And it's one of the reasons why I believe younger adults face a larger cost burden. We see that Gen Zers and millennials are more stressed about the cost of holiday travel. And that's likely because those 20 and 30 somethings are the ones who are going home to mom and dad's or grandma and grandpa's, and maybe they're bringing their own kids in tow. A lot of times that holiday travel burden falls on the younger adults.
So when it comes to the budget that they have, I guess I'm thinking if they're going home to see mom and dad, or if my kid comes home to see me, they stay at home. They don't, other than gas to drive or airfare, I don't know what they would have to spend. Where does that fit in all of this?
Yeah, these are averages that are blending everything. So different household sizes, different types of trips. For those who are flying for Thanksgiving or Christmas, the average per household is about $1,000. Again, though, that could be, you know, larger families bumping up some of the cost. Same thing for hotels and short-term rentals. For those staying in one for Thanksgiving or for those staying in one around Christmas and New Year's, that too is around $1,000 on average per family. So if you're doing all four, it's an average of about $4,000. Now, you're right, not everybody is spending that much. Actually, surprisingly few people are flying for the holidays. It's only about 1 in 10. But those who are often spending a lot. It's kind of just one more thing. You know, that's one of the key findings here, is that it's not just travel prices that are high. Travel prices have actually stabilized or even come down in some cases, but it's everything else. It's like this is one more thing on top of higher housing costs and higher grocery bills and higher everything bills. And that's really why inflation is straining people. It's that cumulative effect.
And presents, right? You got to get presents.
Yep, 1 in 3 holiday shoppers are making changes because of inflation. So I thought that was notable, that the cutbacks are more clear on travel. Maybe we are starting to hit the end of this revenge travel thing. You know, it surprised me ever since the pandemic. I understood 2022 was going to be a huge year for travel and things reopening. Last year topped it, though, according to the TSA checkpoint numbers. This year is topping it again. We don't normally see this when people are worried about the economy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even though a lot of the economic data has been pretty good, sentiment has been bad the past several years. Inflation's been straining people, and yet they've still been spending robustly on discretionary things like travel and dining and concert tickets. And I would attribute a lot of that to this you only live once thing that developed during and after the pandemic, but maybe we're starting to find our limit here, because travel demand has not been as strong the past few months as it was in the past few years.
You only live once, Ted, but it's going to seem a lot longer when you're trying to pay off that credit card. Am I right?
And that is leading to some adjustments. Yeah, I mean, the fact that credit card balances are at record highs, credit card rates are still close to record highs, even though they've come down a little bit. A lot of people have dipped into savings. Now, maybe what seemed like a good idea a year or two ago now is maybe feeling like a bit of a splurge too far. People do still want to go on the trip, but like I said, they're making changes that, you know, almost everybody is making some sort of change owing to inflation. And it's not just this kind of blank check for travel anymore, like I'm going to spend whatever it takes to go wherever I want to go. It's like, I still want to go, but I'm willing to cut back here and there and save a little money.
I got some more inflation questions for you when we come back, Ted. Also, I want to talk about the reactive nature of the airline industry. And, you know, if they don't sell a seat, that's money lost forever, right? Like an empty seat at a concert. So I just wonder how much less demand on air travel means that prices come down. But then if people start chasing those seats, do the prices go up again? 6:50, 10 till 7, traffic now, WWL. 6:55 and a half, Tommy Tucker, WWL, Tuesday morning, October 22nd. Beautiful sunrise, got some cotton candy clouds off on the horizon. Ted Rossman, our guest, Bankrate senior industry analyst, talking about holiday travel and the effects of inflation on that. More than 4 in 5 holiday travelers are changing their plans due to inflation, according to Bankrate. How reactive is the airline industry, Ted, when it comes to demand? Because I guess I'm thinking from the business standpoint, if I have a flight and I got an empty seat on it, that's money I'll never get back. And I guess you could factor in weight and fuel and all that stuff. But do airlines tend to drop prices for seats that aren't booked? But then if people start chasing those, is it like a dog chasing its tail where the prices go up again?
They've been behind the curve a little bit. They were slow to ramp back up when the post-pandemic travel boom happened. So they were behind in 2021 and 22, and that led to a lot of operational disruptions, like, you know, flights were delayed or canceled because the crew and the equipment weren't there. That's gotten better, but now they've actually oversupplied a little bit, and that's been a drag on profitability. That's something that airlines have been talking about on recent earnings calls, that they've actually been trying to cut back some of their supply a little bit and better calibrate it with demand, because demand's been good, but it started to tail off. So it's always a bit of a delicate balance. Around the holidays, though, I expect full planes, and I would not expect a last-minute deal for holiday travel. For a busy period like that, it's better to book sooner, not later. It's already pretty late for Thanksgiving travel bookings. Even for Christmas, it's getting late. I would say jump on that as soon as you can.
Let me ask you about talk about inflation, generally speaking, if I may. You know, I see these commercials on television, and bear with me if you can, while I lay a foundation here, Ted. You know, you see beautiful actresses or actors on TV, depending on whatever, and it's like, man, I wish I could date them or whatever it is. And then you realize, well, that's not never going to happen. It's just TV, right? It's fiction. But when it comes to commercials and products, I think people sometimes lose sight of the fact that not everybody can afford everything, and that explains the massive credit card debt. And I just wonder how people buying things that they can't afford leads to inflation, and if people would just kind of live within their means, how that might be a problem that would take care of itself. Thoughts?
What's been so difficult about inflation is that it's hit lower-income people the hardest. You know, people that have less slack they can cut from their budget. These are not necessarily people who are going on expensive vacations or, you know, spending a lot on discretionary items, but it's more just the everyday. You know, this has highlighted a lot of inequalities in the economy where, you know, inflation's been an annoyance for everybody, but it's been more of an inconvenience for upper-income households and really more of a crisis for lower-income. When people get into credit card debt, surprisingly, it tends to be practical causes. Emergency expenses are number one. So that's your unexpected car repair or medical bill or something like that. And then second place is day-to-day expenses. That comes in well ahead of vacations and discretionary spending. It's kind of surprising.
I guess I'm wondering about people living beyond their means, because I see so many, you know, cars now being financed for 10 or 12 years, which to me is just crazy. But maybe I'm old school, and I just wonder if really, I don't know. It just seems like if you're financing a car for 10 years, you're going to be putting more into repairs halfway through while you're still paying for the car. That doesn't seem like a good, stable plan. Thoughts?
Those longer-term car loans are a big issue. Yeah, I mean, we're seeing more and more people financing those for 7 years or longer. That costs you a ton of money in interest. It can keep you underwater on the loan for a while. I would try to finance for no more than 4 or 5 years if you can.
And any need for regulation on that, or what do you think? Just let the market decide?
It may be one of those market will bear kind of things. You know, what's tricky is that the longer you go, the more affordable the monthly payment. Mm. So that sounds good to people, but it's that total interest expense that really gets you.
And repairing it while you're still paying for it. Thank you. 7:14 now, beautiful stretch of weather, bone dry, not as cool as I think I would like it. Highs near 80 degrees, but all in all, pretty doggone nice, just in time for the Swifties to invade. I don't mean that in a negative way. To visit, I should say, as Eugene Green, New Orleans City Council member, joins us. How you doing, Eugene?
Good morning, Tommy. I'm just doing fine. Doing fine this morning.
How important is this?
Good to talk to you.
Thank you, sir. How important is this Taylor Swift concert to the city?
Even I didn't know the impact until a meeting last week that we had. I didn't know three concerts, 55,000 people each. But here's the interesting part, that there are so many people who come in town who don't necessarily plan to go to the concert, but who just want to be in town for the excitement. The way that they have to organize the merchandise sales, the way that they have to organize or getting back and forth to the hotel, just incredible preparation for it. But we as a city are a city that can host three major concerts three nights in a row. Our hotels are sufficient and they're going to be filled. It is an incredible thing to see in terms of being on the inside and just seeing how much preparation goes on. We're talking about Homeland Security, New Orleans Police Department, Public Works. We're talking about agencies that work in social services in certain areas. So it's just something that's mobilizing the entire city. But I will tell you this, Tommy, meetings happen behind the scenes, including that press conference, but there was a meeting before the press conference. We as a city are ready for this large event, just as we are ready for many other large events. It's going to be an exciting time.
Is this going to be a good run-through for the Super Bowl?
This is going to be even bigger than the Super Bowl in some respects when you think about the fact that there's three concerts in a row. The hotels are going to be sold out for three nights in a row. And again, some of the issues that are out there, security and the like, and crowd control, yeah, it's going to be a good run for the Super Bowl, but we're going to do well on the Super Bowl. We've had this is the 11th, the record tying in terms of the number of the place that has held the most Super Bowls. So we're going to be ready for it, but this is additional practice in this different time right now because there is a different security issue that we have to address. You know,
you said you didn't know until the meeting. Are you trying to tell me, Eugene Green, and you're not a Swiftie?
Well, great. I have a granddaughter.
Yeah, there you go.
She didn't tell me. Yeah. She didn't tell me 55,000 in a row, like three days in a row. You know, and wait, what she didn't tell me was all of the people who come in town who don't have any plan to go to the game itself, who just come in town to enjoy. So we've had to involve a lot of city departments in that. But at the end of the day, we're ready. Even safety and permits, for example, don't just set up and try to sell some product on a corner because that's not legal, and we are going to have people enforcing that. Get the right permits, be in the right place, do the right thing to those who want to try to take advantage and hurt the others who have done the right thing.
And look, I'm all for Taylor Swift. I think she's a marvelous young woman, and I just don't know the music so much. I know the business angle of it, and it's huge for the city. It's huge for wherever she goes.
The business angle is an incredible angle, and yes, we're going to do it right. You know, we do it right very often, and it's going to be maybe the kind of thing that gets us other events, maybe gets us another Super Bowl, because right after the Super Bowl, we're going to be competing for the next opportunity, the next vacant opportunity. And I think that our showing here, plus the Super Bowl, plus, of course, in the meantime, we're going to have the Sugar Bowl and we're going to have other parades. We'll just continue to show everyone that we can handle large events. So I'm looking forward to it.
So let's talk about the budget hearings that's gone on so far, things that have gotten your attention, things that you think that you agree with, maybe things you don't agree with so much.
Well, the one thing that has gotten my attention more than anything else is that, of course, everybody who presents wants additional money because that's just the way things work, whether it be inflation, whether it be the cost of certain products, whether it be the employee, the staff raises that we're giving to city employees, 2.5%, there's a demand for more money. So we've had to work a little bit harder because we as a city council heard the concerns of our residents relative to insurance and increased assessments, and we did not roll forward our millage, which means there was no additional revenue due to millage. So we've got to make the tough decisions relative to the fact that there are demands, but not the revenues there to have those increases that people want. So we have to be responsible. We want to keep money in the coffers to handle issues such as major storms that might come up. And, of course, you've seen what happened in Texas, North Carolina, Florida. You just can't rely on FEMA being there immediately. There are immediate concerns that have to be addressed. So we're going to have that storm we're going to have the monies reserved that we need to have to cover the storms. But the bottom line is that, in general, there's not additional money available because of the fact that we held taxes, but we did hold taxes in place. So those who advocated for it, they won. No new taxes with us meant no new taxes. And at the end of the day, it means that you make tough decisions on the budget front. But I want to invite the public to view the city council budget hearings, to participate by just simply going online, doing a search of New Orleans City Council, and everything that we're doing is online.
You mentioned permits and what's the other one? Inspections and permits and enforcement with just setting up your this and setting up your that. You're confident, Councilman, that there's going to be enough people to enforce that and make sure that none of that goes on? Or at least it's limited, not none.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't say none.
I know what you mean. The bottom line
never
is
say
that
never, and never say none, right?
Right. There are going to be some people out there who are going to set up, and they're not going to have their permit displayed, and they may not be asked. But the bottom line is that why take that risk? Call the Office of Safety and Permits or task down City Hall and see if you can get a permit to do business at a particular location so that you don't run afoul of the law. But there will always be someone who tries to do something that's a little bit behind the scenes, but they hurt other businesses. And I'm a strong proponent of if certain businesses do it right, if they get the permits that they need, if they have the health concerns addressed that they need, that they should be able to do business. But the bottom line is that safety and permits, because there's also a zone in place that restricts your ability to sell certain products that compete with those who have paid for the things that they are supposed to do correctly. The bottom line is that it's the Office of Safety and Permits, NOLA.gov/safety and permits, or just stop in the city hall, speak to a person, and do the right thing.
I believe it's Harvard alum Eugene Green, is it not?
Harvard alum,
I
yes,
so,
so
yeah.
Proud.
I bet.
But in the city of New Orleans, I'll tell you, St. Augustine High School and Harvard, because the St. Augustine High
that
School
carries more weight. That carries more weight than the Harvard does, I guarantee you that. 7:21,
right.
We'll pick it up when we come back with Eugene Green, New Orleans City Council member. Time now, traffic, WWL. 7:26 and a half, Tommy Tucker, WWL, joined by St. Aug, Purple Knight, Eugene Green, New Orleans City Council member, which, of course, here trumps a Harvard education. Talking about the, it's true, talking about the Taylor Swift concert, security in the city, budget, et cetera. When it comes to public works and streetlight repairs and so forth, what would you like to see? Let me ask you this, council member. Where would you like to see, if you were to triage improvement from different city departments, what would you rank at the top of the list, streetlights, et cetera? What would you like to see taken care of, maybe top three?
Well, when you say improvements, I will just make it clear that the streetlights are being replaced. I mean, there was a time when in New Orleans there were 4,000 lights out, and now we're less than 1,000. There are just a lot of lights throughout the city, tens of thousands of them. I would certainly like to see more done, but I will tell you, it's not because the money's not available many times. It's because the companies that want to do business with us don't have the personnel. You can't just go up on a lift and change a light. It could be a ballast, so you have to have qualified personnel. But All-Star Electric is making repairs every day, and I think that everyone will agree out there, minus maybe the interstates, which is not just New Orleans alone responsibility. But the bottom line is that I'd like to see more of the streetlights in place. But I will tell you this, people are concerned about the streetlights many times in the neighborhoods because they're concerned about crime. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you that New Orleans has the highest rate of decrease in crime, in violent crime in the nation. Shootings, armed robberies, homicides, and carjackings are all down nearly 40% 24 versus 23. I still sympathize with, understand, and will always remember the victims of crime. And I just want to say that we're going in the right direction. But I would say in the area of streetlights, look, in terms of city streets, we will never, ever repair every street in the city of New Orleans. Our streets sink at a certain rate per year. But the bottom line is that I do see, and I don't know if you see my newsletter, I try to highlight the fact that many, many blocks are getting fixed. But I recognize as you drive throughout the city, it looks like the work is never going to be ended. We can do better in terms of getting more street work done. That involves working with the contractors and also getting more personnel in the areas where we need to get them. We have throughout the city of New Orleans an unfortunate, and it's private sector too. I don't know where everybody is. We don't have people working in certain areas where they used to work, and it's harder to get them. But we do have improvements 2023 versus 2022 based on the reports that people are making, our department heads are making. I think we're moving in the right direction. If there's any area in which I'd like to see some very measurable change, it's in filling the vacancies within City Hall. We still have hundreds of vacancies combined, including in our New Orleans Police Department.
Let me get this real quick, Council Member, if I can, about the early voting's underway. Anything on the ballot in Orleans Parish you want to bring people's attention to?
Well, there is an initiative relative to a Workers' Bill of Rights and also an initiative relative to creating a housing trust fund. The housing trust fund committee, the housing trust fund issue would allow there to be more addressing of affordable housing needs in our city, providing resources for homeownership and also for rental assistance and to invest with investors who are doing work in affordable housing. And there's also a Workers' Bill of Rights that the city council passed to give an opportunity for persons who are concerned about issues involving workers to have a say in making sure that those things change. So I encourage our citizens to look at those two New Orleans issues and to go out and vote early. You can vote all the way through next Tuesday, 8:30 a.m. until 6 p.m., just not Sunday, at one of five locations. You can find those locations by going to the Secretary of State's office. Please vote.
Thank you, Councilman. Appreciate your time. We'll take a break. We come back. We're going to talk to Barry Keim, LSU climatologist, about hellacious rain. Right now it's time for WWL First News. 7:45, quarter till 8, bone dry for the next, I guess, 10 days as we welcome in Barry Keim, LSU climatologist, not an official meteorological term, but would that be accurate, Barry?
Yeah, very much so.
Bone dry for the next 10 days, highs around 80 degrees. So really nice weather. I mean, it's not very Halloweenish or no frost on the pumpkin like that, but when you think about it, plenty of sunshine is kind of like Las Vegas weather, although having lived there, it's a little bit cooler there this time of year. But we're getting way, way off the topic. How you been, Barry?
I'm good. This is Chamber of Commerce weather, man. What are you talking about?
It really is. Now, did you tell me something about the Chalmette Owls? Was that you?
That was me. Yeah. I need to hear about this extra point.
Back in the glory days, man. I'm going to tell you what. It was at Haas Memphis, I believe. It was not, because the senior season was at Chalmette, but it was a defensive struggle, and thankfully there was a hero, number 67, to kick that extra point and win the game 7-6. But, hey, look, let's not talk about that. Let's talk about hellacious rains. Tell me what's going on here with the climate. I saw a story by David Mitchell at NOLA.com about hellacious rains hitting Louisiana in 2021 and new research showing how bad it really was. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so this is a storm that it caused over $1 billion in damage in Texas and Louisiana. It caused 5 deaths. 2,700 homes were damaged in this event. And nobody even knows about it. And it's just kind of bizarre how so many things just flip under the radar.
Yeah, let me go back for a second. Under the radar, nice choice of words there. But this was mid-May. This is not a hurricane or anything. This was just something how did it come about in May 2021?
Well, think about May 3rd, 1978, and May 1995 in New Orleans. May is a weird month that the ingredients can come together and produce these colossal storms. That's just crazy. So this one, the one that we wrote this paper on, was in May 19th and 20th, 2021. It was produced by a system we call a mesoscale convective system. Very technical meteorological term. There's all sorts of things that go into it. Bottom line is, generally at nighttime, we get this, we call a low-level jet coming off the Gulf of Mexico up into the United States, and it just transports all this moisture and intersects with a thunderstorm, and it produces a massive amount of rain across usually small areas. In this case, an area south of Beaumont picked up 20 inches, Lake Charles had 15 inches, Baton Rouge had a couple of places that were 10 inches or more. And all this rain fell in like 6 hours. And that's what causes the big problem. I mean, these rains, we've seen bigger rain numbers, right, over a number of days. But when you concentrate that much rain into a short period of time, like 6 or 12 hours, the natural environmental systems can't deal with it. And we produce these colossal floods where people die, unfortunately. And, and we've had lots of these big rainstorms in recent years. I mean, if you think back, I mean, Hurricane Harvey just a few years ago, over 50 inches of rain in 5 days. And then Imelda had like 40 to 45 inches in 2 to 3 days. And, of course, we have our August 2016 flood where we were at about 31, 32 inches of rain in 2 days. Just crazy. And, of course, more recently, Hurricane Helene, with these heavy rains over North Carolina. Some of the preliminary work we've looked at, we're looking at about, several places that had 30 inches or more in a relatively short period of time. So this is becoming a pattern at this particular point.
All right, let me take a quick break. We'll pick it up when we come back, talking to Barry Keim, LSU climatologist, about the storm of May 2021. If I remember correctly, the legislature was in session and they had a big vote that they were trying to get everybody in there to take, and I don't remember exactly what it was about, but I think that's the storm we were talking about. 7:49 now, traffic, WWL. 7:54, 6 till 8, Tommy Tucker talking to Barry Keim, our friend, LSU climatologist. We watch these storms in the Gulf, the hurricanes, and we follow them for days and days and days, and we worry about the path and storm surge, and in a lot of cases, torrential rainfall, which causes maybe as more damage than, maybe not deaths or flooding, but more damage than does the actual storm itself. However, in this case, this was mid-May 2021, blew up overnight, Barry. Is that accurate?
Yeah, that's entirely accurate. I mean, most of the rain fell late in the evening and into the wee hours of the morning. And it's just amazing how much rain can be produced in some of these events. And it seems to be getting worse. That's the thing. And what this kind of points to is the sea surface temperatures in the Gulf of Mexico have been running really, really warm, well above normal for the last few years. And this has been a recurring pattern. And then, of course, the temperatures have been warmer. And by virtue of that, and this is getting into some science, but there's something called the Clausius-Clapeyron equation. And again,
wait, you want to bring science into the conversation about the climate? What?
Yeah, just a little bit.
Well, okay. And I'll allow it, but watch yourself.
So for every degree that the temperature is warmer, it can carry 4 to 5% more moisture. So for every degree that the climate warms, that's 4 to 5% more moisture that these storms can carry, and ultimately produce produce rain and put it on the ground. So there is something to that, and like I said, these storms like Hurricane Helene just a few weeks ago, 30 inches of rain over parts of North Carolina. I mean, that's crazy. And we're seeing these big rain totals occur over and over again. And just think about New Orleans. I mean, when I was growing up, neutral ground parking wasn't even a thing, and now it's commonplace. And obviously there are other confounding factors that lead to that, but nevertheless, it does seem that the climate is producing more rainfall, and we do have some studies to back that up. I mean, we're looking, storms seem to be getting shorter in duration and more intense over time. And when I say over time, like over the last 50, 60, 70 years, there is a pattern in the climate that is discernible, and we're able to pick it up.
So to bring recollection into it, not science, it seems to me as though the big May 3rd flood was, I hate to use the phrase watershed, but you can't talk about any of this without making a bad pun. That is what opened, again, the floodgates on all of these I'm sorry, Barry, but you can't help it.
You're on a roll, man.
There are so many metaphors. But it seemed like as though that's what started these 1-in-100-year rainfalls. Is there any scientific evidence to say that?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, oddly enough, Tommy, I did my master's thesis on heavy rainfalls in New Orleans, and you're exactly right. May 3rd, 1978 was the start of these really big, colossal rainstorms across the New Orleans area anyway. Prior to that, we had a kind of a quiet period for about 30 years. You have to go all the way back into the 50s, really, the 40s and 50s, before you start seeing big storms like we've seen more recently. And we just let our guard down, and as a result, then when these things pop up again, and they're probably getting even worse now than they were back in the 20s and 30s. And we have some serious problems. I mean, land continues to subside, and we continue to, build in places we probably shouldn't be building in, and then we have all these problems across the city of New Orleans.
I remember seeing, and for those of you, we apologize for the connection that Barry's on, but there's nothing you can do. It's a connection. He's not on speakerphone. We've already checked into that. We just want to hear what he has to say, so we appreciate his time. Barry, I saw a picture, and I saved it on the phone because it was of flooding after a torrential rainstorm, and the houses were flooded except for the one in the area that was raised. And it seems as though back in the day we were building raised houses because we live in a bowl, and then we got away from it. Is there something to that when it comes to building that maybe people ought to start building raised houses again?
Well, yeah, I mean, it makes perfect sense to do that. And then to take the next step, if you live in South Louisiana, or really anywhere in Louisiana, you probably should have flood insurance, whether you think you need it or not. Just have it. But the building codes certainly play a big role. I'm in Old Metairie. I'm on the ridge, and my house is built up off the ground. Now I still can flood. I mean, it's still a possibility, but I've taken most of the precautions that I feel like I can take to protect my life and property. And I just think we could probably do a whole lot more across the city to do better on that.
Barry, 20 seconds left. Any chance that we go in another 30-year dry cycle?
In the weather and climate business, we never say never. So the answer is sure, it's possible. And since we do have so little time, I mean, every story has a hero. Number 67, Shaw Eagles, baby.
Thank you, Barry. I appreciate it. We'll take a break. Come back. Talk with Tim Temple, Louisiana Insurance Commissioner, WWL. All right, 8:15 now on this Tuesday morning. Going to be a nice day and a nice stretch of weather, really. I heard Chris Franklin, WWL, Louisiana chief meteorologist, yesterday say that as far as he's concerned, he was calling it for the hurricane season, and he figured that if you look at what's going on out there right now and then if you look at the trends, that we're pretty well in the clear, which meant I'm going to Home Depot and getting some plywood. Just kidding, Chris. Tim Temple joins us now, Louisiana Insurance Commissioner. How you doing, Tim?
Good morning. It is a beautiful day today.
It is, and do you think it's okay to sound the all clear or not?
Look, I'm not going to go that far. You never know what's going to happen. I'm going to wait until we get out of November.
I admire Chris for saying that. I really do, and I hope he's right. Let's talk about the effects of Francine, I guess, and more importantly, Helene, and what that could have to do with the insurance rates that we in Louisiana pay. And Milton, too.
Yeah, you know, Milton. Yeah, well, and I think that's the ones that, Helene and Milton are the ones that everybody is looking at now to see what that total damage is going to come in. And I'll tell you, the reports that I read and the conversations I've had, it's coming in as the word is manageable. If you look at just look at Florida, and after they had Ian a couple of years ago, that was a $65 billion loss. Mm-hmm. It looks like Helene and Milton are going to come in less than half of that. So, again, the word is manageable, but I do want to remind your listeners that reinsurance is a global market. It's a global product, and things that happen around the country and around the world have the potential to impact reinsurance rates. But again, I look at the reports and I read a bunch of different trade publications, and globally it looks like catastrophic losses are coming in lower than forecast. But again, we've got we're not out of this year yet. So it looks like we're trending in the right direction so that reinsurance isn't going to be a major factor, but we got to hold out until see what the next 2 months bring.
You're generous with your time, and you and I have spoken about this repeatedly, as you have with Newell, but people are bombarded with, 5,000 messages a day now, while you and I know about reinsurance. I don't know as much as you do. But the average person listening right now might not have any idea what in the heck we're talking about. So if you will, Tim, take some time, talk about how what happens worldwide with the reinsurance market affects insurance companies and what we have to pay for homeowners coverage here.
Well, yeah, and I appreciate it, Tommy. So just like you and I buy insurance to spread our risk so that we're not financially responsible for 100% of whether it's our car, our home, medical bills, workers' comp, whatever it is that we're purchasing, insurance companies do the same thing. They purchase insurance, but when they do it, it's called reinsurance. And it's a global market, and it just helps insurance companies spread their risk as well. And after we saw with, Laura, Delta, Zeta, Ida in 2021, and then with Ian in Florida later in 21, those were huge losses that the reinsurance companies and the insurance companies spent a lot of money writing claims checks. And so they had to, refill the coffers, if you will. And that's when we saw rates going up dramatically. I think a lot of people remember Louisiana Citizens that had that policy. I believe it was in 20, I think it was 22. It was before I was commissioner. I think it was 22, reinsurance cost made the premium go up. I think it was 63%, 62% just because of reinsurance. And so it is important. We do pay attention to it. We can't do anything about the cost of capital, but that's the reason that I'm always focused on things that we can control here in our state, the regulatory environment, the legal environment, and also the physical risk, making sure that we're building more resilient structures. I'm focused on things we can control, but I'm also, cognizant and aware of things that are beyond our control so that we can at least talk about it and be prepared for it.
I was talking to Barry Keim just now, Tim, a climatologist from LSU, about, I got a picture. I saw it on television. I saved it to my phone because it was a neighborhood that was flooded after a torrential rain, and the only house that wasn't flooded was the one that was older and built, raised, like they used to in the old days, because they knew that, we were below sea level, and when it rained, it flooded, and it seems as though times are short, memories rather are short, time passes. And I always go back to the example of the Mississippi Gulf Coast after Camille. They were building 20 feet up on the ground, and they came down about a foot every year to building ranch-style homes again. So I guess what I'm wondering, we can take a break here. You can pick it up when we come back. As you talk about, you know, we know about fortified roofs and so forth. Is it time to really reexamine the building codes and maybe build everything elevated? That's not going to help with wind and hail, I realize that, or fire, but it would help with flood, which is a national program. And also, another question that I have, and I don't know if you know the answer or not, but how do reinsurers spread their risk? Because it would seem as though they would want to at some point limit their liability as well. Having a conversation with Tim Temple, Louisiana Insurance Commissioner. If you have any questions, comments, 504-260-1870. And along those lines, in addition to elevated houses, what else can we do besides fortified roofs to make our houses more impervious to any hurricane threats or any damage? 821 traffic now, WWL. 8:25 and a half, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Tim Temple, Louisiana Insurance Commissioner, about reinsurance and Milton and Helene. The good news, relatively good news, I guess, Tim, is that Ian caused $65 billion of damage. Helene and Milton combined less than half of that. So as it relates to the reinsurance market and the global market and everything, let me get to this first. How do reinsurers, because I know you're an insurance guy, how do reinsurers spread their risk? Because somebody eventually is going to have to eat something, right?
Yeah, and look, you're right. Reinsurance companies do the same thing. They spread their risk and reduce their loss of catastrophic, events. So when they buy it, it's called a retrocession. It's just a different word, for everybody to get to learn. But you've got insurance, reinsurance, and then retrocession. But it's the same financial policy. You're taking and spreading your risk, but. You had mentioned earlier a couple of things that I wanted to make sure we address. And, you're right. You were talking about, after prior hurricanes, catastrophic events, people kind of learn a lesson. And then over time, they kind of go back to the ways of old. And, I think that's one of the keys that, planning commissions need to be more engaged. And I'm going to say take a little bit more authority and just helping people decide, where they can build. Mm-hmm. We all know, and we grew up where, certain areas you just never built there because it flooded, or, scenarios where you didn't want to go in this area for other weather related events. And nowadays you're seeing, developers come in, they buy that land because it's cheap, and then they put concentration of properties there. Yep. And so we've got to acknowledge that, and we've got to figure out a better way to do it. But we also need to look at concentration because, we're certainly being impacted here in Louisiana. But if you've ever traveled to Florida and you see the multitude of high-rise buildings and remember what it was 20 years ago, there weren't as many then. And so when you do have an event and it comes in, it impacts more homes. We have hailstorms that go through Nebraska, and decades ago, it didn't do any damage other than crop damage, which is certainly an issue. But nowadays, you've got, fields where there used to be fields, there's now neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. And so we've got to acknowledge that concentration is an issue. You talked about elevating homes. And I know the Corps is getting ready, reading that article yesterday and having talked to some folks about, the Corps is going to come in and elevate a bunch of properties so that we get them out of the floodplain, mm-hmm. which I'm certainly supportive of. But we're only doing half the job. We're going to elevate these properties, but yet we're not going to fortify the roofs.
Right.
I'm trying to work, and we're getting ready to engage with the federal delegation, the federal government to say, don't spend money just elevating a home so it doesn't flood. Let's go ahead and put a fortified roof on that too, because that is a key element in helping make Louisiana more affordable from an insurance perspective.
Tim, let me get to this real quick, and I think it's important because it goes to the private nature, I probably traded companies, I guess insurance companies are or not, I don't know, but it's not a government-run entity, right? It says, ask Tim about the hundreds of millions of dollars insurance companies spend on advertisements, but they say they're broke. And you see Aaron Rodgers and who's the other guy? Whoever it is, the Kansas City quarterback. Can't think of his name right now. Patrick Mahomes, and doing all these State Farm commercials. But these are private companies, and they can spend their money how they want, and you can't force them to write insurance. And that's where the issue comes in. And the corollary is, okay, if you want a government-run insurance plan, you got flood insurance, right?
That's right. I mean, I don't think anybody wants FEMA to come in and run a catastrophe program. You know, and look, we talk about the advertising thing, and I know that the battle over the Capitol has been this, you know, the battle forever has taken place on advertising. And I don't think that's where we need to focus. You know, everybody, I mean, look, it is a First Amendment right that you have, you know, freedom to advertise. And I think that that's a red herring. You know, if they start, you know, if people want to say, let's look at how much people are spending on advertising, then that's got to go all the way around the table.
Well, and that, Tim,
and I don't know that everybody wants to talk about that.
Well, then you're talking about, are you going to make it a public utility? Are you going to regulate it that way? And then if so, who's going to write insurance? And you're back to a quasi-governmental thing. Never enough time. You have to come back, all right?
Hey, anytime. I'm always happy to, Tommy. This is a complex issue, and I appreciate the opportunity to call.
And there are no simple solutions. Thank you, sir. Tim Temple, Louisiana Insurance Commissioner, taking a break. Coming back, talking to Steve Geller, WWL Sports Director. In case you've not heard, Dennis Allen has said that, make no mistake about it, when it comes to Sunday's game, your starting quarterback will be Duretla. Time now, WWL First News. All right, 8:46, 14 to 9, Causeway southbound closed. A fire is standing, a vehicle fire at mile marker 22.5. And thanks for those of you texting in. They say they're letting emergency vehicles go through. I'm sure Carlton Dufresne will let us know as soon as that Causeway southbound reopens. Meanwhile, be apprised of that fact that if you're coming from the North Shore to the South Shore, the causeway is currently closed, so you may want to either wait or take an alternative route. Steve Geller joins us now, WWL Sports Director. How you doing, Steve?
I've been hanging in there, Tommy. How you been today?
I am okay, sir. Tell me what the Saints have been doing since the Thursday night effort against it's been a long time. Tim, Thursday night.
against Denver.
Denver. There. How could I forget that? Sean Payton and the Broncos. How did they arrange your schedule? Do you know?
Yeah, Sean. Not Sean. See, you got me now. Dennis Allen gave the team some time off. Obviously, this team, we know the black and gold are banged up. So guys got a little extra time for some rest. But someone like a Derek Carr did put in a throwing session on Saturday. He did get one Monday as well, and will go again today. They're going to test that oblique issue with him going into this week 8 matchup already. Yeah, the black and gold now, you know, have lost 5 in a row and could end up turning to Spencer Rattler again as their starting quarterback if Carr's not able to go. They tried to at least ramp him up to be the emergency backup quarterback for last week. That's why Dennis Allen said he was listed as doubtful on the injury report, but come game time, Carr was inactive for the team, so it wasn't like even an emergency capacity. He was good to go with the oblique issue, so we're kind of still waiting to see how that goes with his throwing session today after doing yesterday, today, back-to-backs. See how that responds, but right now, it's looking like we're going to see another go for the Rattler under center.
Rattler!
Exactly. It's fun to say. From Seinfeld when it says Bobby A. Bear. It's just fun to say.
It is.
Rattler is fun to say, too. But hopefully, you know, we see more improvement from the youngster. It's been a little bit of a rough go. He's been pretty, you know, decent completion-wise when he's not under duress. Obviously, when the rookies face some pressure, things have been a lot different, and also turnover-wise as well. But I think overall what we're seeing from him is definitely a promising prospect in the Saints' fifth-round draft pick.
I was concerned during the game Thursday night against the Broncos late before Jake Haener came in because he grabbed his side, and I thought he might have another oblique issue. What do we know about that? Anything?
They called it a hip pointer, but things that they're saying that going into this week's matchup against the Chargers that he should be A-OK. I thought maybe with Hayner's performance right at the end of the game, able to orchestrate that, you know, touchdown drive in the game. Maybe they turn to him to give him a look as the starting quarterback, but Dennis Allen has made it clear that Rockwell will be the guy going forward still.
I think that had a lot to do maybe, too, with the situation that they were in and what kind of defense the Denver Broncos were playing. And maybe, yeah, I understand what I'm saying. They were playing pretty soft, right, at that point in the game?
Yeah, and you look at also that Denver Broncos front was pretty vicious, one of the highest sack rates, one of the highest blitz rates, at least in the NFL. And I know their sack numbers are up there as well, too. And poor Rattler has 11 sacks in his first two starts in the league. You know, obviously the young man still learning his way in the NFL.
Let me take a break because we got some traffic problems. We'll pick it up. We come back 8:50, 10 till 9, 2 traffic now on WWL. All right, 8:55, 5 till 9. One lane of the causeway is now open southbound. I believe Carlton Dufour showed is busy, but reached out to the newsroom and said that they should have everything cleared up, hopefully by 9:30. But one lane of the causeway is open southbound now. Be aware of that and expect the customary and usual delays. Steve Geller, WWL Sports Director, our guest, talking about the Saints and Daratla. And tell me who he's going to throw to. They got a new receiver they signed or not?
Yeah, that's a great question, Tommy. Obviously, we know Rashid Shaheed put on the shelf dealing with an injury after having meniscus surgery, so he's going to miss the rest of this year. Chris Olave, still in the concussion protocol. Dennis Allen wouldn't elaborate anymore or said he couldn't elaborate anymore due to NFL, you know, rules and the regulations there. But Olave still trying to clear that concussion protocol, so that puts his status still in question for Sunday against the Chargers. So the team is bringing in Marquez Valdes-Scantling, a guy that we know spent a ton of time with the Green Bay Packers and Aaron Rodgers. And then the last this past season was with the Buffalo Bills the last six games and also spent time winning two Super Bowls, a guy with the Kansas City Chiefs. So a veteran presence for this team, a deep threat with losing someone for sure, and a Rashid Shaheed. Hasn't had much action, though, in Buffalo this year. I think it's two receptions in six games this season, and they ended up letting him go after the Bills were able to make a trade for Amari Cooper, giving, you know, I guess the Saints a chance at a veteran presence here in that locker room at wide receiver, because right now you got a lot of young guys back there, inexperienced, and obviously with a young rookie quarterback getting his feet wet, not the idealist situation for this team right now.
No, and Amari Cooper contributed on Sunday for the Bills, so apparently it made the right choice for them. Let's talk about Paulson Adebo. What are they going to do with him being out with his broken leg?
Oof, yeah, just brutal with him, obviously. You never like to see that from a young guy, especially he's heading into a contract year, so it'll be interesting to see what ends up happening with Adebo, a broken femur. Then with the curious question now, too, with Marshawn Lattimore leaving last game with the hamstring issue, you definitely have some question marks on your outside corner position for this game as well. Dennis Allen did say that we would see someone like Alante Taylor move to the outside for Adebo, so that'll open up the slot, you know, the slot role, which I think you'll end up seeing the rookie and Kool-Aid McKinstry move into that spot. Also possible someone like an Ugo Amadi for this team as well. But man, oh man, you know, you talk about when it rains, it pours with injuries. This team just front to back dealing with a ton of stuff, offense, defense. Hopefully we can get someone like a Taysom Hill and a Cesar Ruiz back this week for this team. We'll find out, obviously, a little bit more when that injury report, the initial one, comes out tomorrow.
Los Angeles Chargers lost last night to the Cardinals, but at least they're coming off a somewhat short week. The Saints got the longer time to prepare. What can we look for when the Saints play them on Sunday?
Yeah, sadly, with this Harbaugh now run offense in the Chargers, they got a stud at quarterback in a Justin Herbert. Hasn't been having the greatest year on the Chargers either, but man, oh man, Harbaugh wants to run the football, and that scares the bejesus out of me, considering the last couple games against this Saints defense, they've been just paper mache. Guys have been running through them, so if you have J.K. Dobbins in fantasy football, he is definitely a must-start against this Saints defense. Hopefully they can tighten some things up, but man, oh man, right now you look at that Saints D-line, they're not the ones that are hurting, so they got no excuses of why things are not happening up front.
Thank you, Steve Gell. Appreciate it as always. How's that young man doing at Rummel?
Doing all right. The ninth graders got their first win of the season this past week, so things are looking up for them.
Woohoo! Go Raiders! Tim Zimmer says Raider pride. Steve Geller's son's an offensive lineman. That's going to be a big young man. Watch for him. I'm telling you, he's going to wind up playing at LSU. Right?
That's his dream.
Okay. All right. Just want to make sure he stays in state. Steve Geller, WWL Sports Director. We'll take a break. We come back. We'll talk with Jake Madison, host of Locked On Pelicans. Causeway, southbound, one lane open, had a fire earlier. Details coming up and more here on WWL. All right, 9:09 now on this Tuesday morning. Here we go. New Orleans Pelicans basketball. Your New Orleans Pelicans tipping off the regular season tomorrow against the Chicago Bulls in the Smoothie King Center. You can catch Pels Bulls pregame 6:30. Tip off 7 o'clock tomorrow on WWL AM, FM, and WWL.com, and streaming on the Odyssey app. We're delighted to have Pelicans basketball, and we're delighted to be joined now by Jake Madison, host of Locked On Pelicans. How you doing, Jake?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me on this morning.
Thanks for taking the time. Let's start with the Trey Murphy extension. How important was it to get one done before the season, and how important is he to the Pels?
I think this was something they had to get done, and I think the deal, 4 years, $112 million, is a win-win for both sides. Trey Murphy gets, you know, generational money here. New Orleans locks him in on a four-year deal, and this is a guy that they consider a future starter. Yes, he's injured right now, will miss the opener tomorrow night, but this is someone who I think will be starting by the middle of this season. And when you look at the core guys on this team, it's built around Zion Williamson. Zion Williamson's best net rating, so basically the most effective lineup he has, includes Trey Murphy in it. When you pair him in one other player and look at the stats, the stats say Trey Murphy is the most important guy to put alongside Zion Williamson with that deep three-point shooting that he has, spacing the court for a guy that attacks the rim like Zion Williamson. This was a really good deal. They get him in at under $30 million per year, and that might seem like a little bit of sticker shock, but in the age of a rising salary cap where there's more money in the NBA than there ever has been before, this is something like 16% of the salary cap. That's going to be a steal for a starter in the future, and I think in a couple of years we'll look at this, and it'll be one of the better contracts in the league.
What do we know about his hamstring?
It sounds like it's healing pretty well. Hamstrings can be tricky. He's not going to be available on opening night. I imagine he'll get reevaluated this week. We'll see him maybe return to play in a week to 2 weeks, I think, so he won't miss too much time to start the year.
From what I know of hamstrings, having been through them and talking to so many orthopedists throughout the years and doctors, it seems as though it's, you know, the NBA season, I don't have to tell you, is a long one, but it seems like hamstrings can be problematic if you go before you're ready. So I guess the Pelicans are going to play it on the safe side, I would think.
Yeah, you know, they dealt with this 2 years ago with Zion Williamson, where on New Year's Eve he suffered a hamstring injury and it basically ruled him out for the rest of the year. There's not a whole lot you can do other than just rest and let your body heal itself when it comes to these. This wasn't as serious of a hamstring injury, it sounds like, as others are, but you definitely do not want to rush back from this type of injury early. And I think it's also better to miss games earlier in the season than late in the season, too. This is a team that has enough talent here. They should be in playoff contention. The last thing you want is a situation like last year where Zion Williamson suffered another hamstring injury, missed that first-round series where they got swept against the Oklahoma City Thunder. You want Trey Murphy ready for the stretch run with that three-point shooting, with that court spacing. And I think the Pelicans tend to play injuries kind of cautious, and we'll probably see the same approach with Trey here.
If I know that, if you know that, certainly the Pelicans know that, right?
You would hope, but given some of the injury history they've had in the past, you never know. But they have gotten better on that front, particularly the past year or so. So I'm hopeful that we won't see any sort of setback or anything like that. Trey's been doing some shooting work on the court. Once he's cleared to play, they've got to ramp him back up with some light conditioning, slowly getting a little bit more before they put him back into a full game. So I think they'll take the cautious approach. They'll handle this injury correctly. This is now a core piece of their roster going forward. Him, Herb Jones, Zion Williamson, DeJounte Murray, who they traded for this offseason. They're not going to do anything that would jeopardize his season or his career.
I hate, and look, no injury is good, but man, I hate to even hear about a hamstring. Speaking of core, the Pelicans got a pretty solid core locked up for a few years.
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, they addressed one of the two biggest needs they had this offseason, and that was a point guard and a center. The center still remains a big question mark for this team, but I think they feel by trading for DeJounte Murray, moving him back to his natural position of point guard, he's going to add a lot to this team. One of the issues that they had at the end of last season was struggling to win close games. Late in the fourth quarter, a close game, they did not do a good job. In fact, they were 0-22 when trailing after three quarters. DeJounte Murray, and coming over from the Atlanta Hawks, is a guy that's won crunch games before, those close games where he's hit big-time shots. They think just that ability alone is going to really elevate this team going forward. He's not even 30 years old yet. This is a guy that could average 10 assists per game this season. They think pairing him with Zion Williamson is just going to unlock this offense a little bit more. That was where they struggled last year. But he also fits in defensively. He leads the league in the past, I think, 3 years in steals per game, alongside Herb Jones, who made the all-defensive team last year. They should form a pretty formidable defense that's going to lock down some backcourt players, and I think they're very optimistic about their chances this year.
How about preseason? What did we see?
We didn't see a whole lot. It's preseason. You don't want to put, you know, too much emphasis on that, but you know, we did not see what we presume is going to be the starting lineup out there. Brandon Ingram only played in the final game. Zion played in the first two. They had one canceled that was supposed to be played in Florida due to Hurricane Milton. So preseason was a mixed bag. There's definitely some cause for concern. Rebounding looked like it could be an issue. This team is a little bit small if they don't start a traditional center, and I don't know if they really will on opening night. So there's still, I think, more questions than answers around this team. There's a lot of talent, but the question is, how does it all fit? Can you make it work? And that's going to be the big challenge for head coach Willie Green this season, to be able to put those pieces out there on the court in a way that makes sense. So I think we're going to get the first true test tomorrow night against the Chicago Bulls, and I'm excited to see what we're going to find out there on the court.
You know, I'm getting a text here from some people, a couple of different texts, asking about small ball. They don't understand what small ball is in basketball. Break that down, and that's what the Pelicans would be doing this year without a real starting center?
Yeah, you know, they still might go with a traditional lineup, which is your point guard, shooting guard, small forward, power forward, and then your biggest man in the center position. And they have some players that can do that. But whoever, if they were to start a traditional center, you're going to probably be rolling out the worst starting center in the league out of all 30 teams. And I think the Pelicans just want to put their best five guys out there on the court, and that means a small ball lineup, so a non-traditional lineup without a starting center. This was popularized by the Golden State Warriors during their, you know, their dynasty run where they won all of those titles. They took Draymond Green, who's only 6'7", 6'8", and had him as their center, and it allowed him just to play fast. Usually those 7-foot centers, those big men, are a little bit slower. And as the NBA has kind of trended towards a more PC league, fast-paced, moving the ball quicker, you need guys that are a little bit more mobile. 7-foot centers aren't always that. Some are, but the Pelicans don't have one of those guys. So if you're playing with a small ball lineup, you're sacrificing size for speed, essentially. It can work. You need to really focus on defensive rebounding, which can be an issue, so the team needs to collectively try and do it. But you hope that even if that is an area that you struggle in, on the offensive end, if a team is starting one of those slower centers, they're not going to be able to keep up with the rest of the roster. And so the Pelicans hope they'll be able to blitz opponents on the offensive end with that small ball lineup. And with Zion Williamson, with a defensive ace in Herb Jones, a shooter in C.J. McCollum, Trey Murphy when he's healthy, Brandon Ingram as your go-to scorer, there's a lot of talent there that should still be able to be effective, even if you're going kind of, you know, against the traditional grain, I guess, with that kind of big starting center out there.
Let's talk about Zion and his conditioning and expectations this season and everything else.
He looks incredible. You know, one of the things we've been waiting for with him is for him to kind of find the maturity you need to succeed at the NBA level, to essentially just be a professional athlete, take care of your body, put in the work in the off season, come into the season in shape. And he hasn't done that yet. And when you look at last season, his year didn't really start until about January. Yes, he was playing before that, but he wasn't in game shape. He was kind of still working his way into being the best version of himself. And it took that 40-point loss to the Los Angeles Lakers in the in-season tournament, an embarrassing game for the Pelicans, for that really to be a wake-up call for him, where he started doing two-a-days to get that conditioning down. This offseason, from seeing him, from talking to him, from talking to people around him, he's been doing it all himself. And it seems like that light bulb has just gone off for him. Better late than never, even though we would have liked this earlier in his career. But just from looking at him, he looks like he's in the best shape of his career. He's realized that maybe some of the weight issues or the lack of conditioning has probably added to some of or caused some of the injuries that he's had in the past, held him back from being the best version of himself out there on the court. And he's doing all of the right things. For whatever reason, the light bulb has gone on. Something has clicked, and he's being the best version of himself. And I'm excited that his season is going to start on Wednesday in October and not in January. This is a guy that, you know, if the Pelicans do well, can be in the MVP conversation, can make one of the three All-NBA teams, proving he's a top 15 guy in the league, something he hasn't been able to do just yet. And if that maturity is there, if he keeps himself healthy all season long, and he played his healthiest year last year in 70 games, this is a guy that's going to be a force in the league and going to be a nightmare for opponents every single night.
You know, we all see it in our kids or our kids' friends where their faces change from being a young adult to a full-grown man or woman. I've seen the same thing in Zion, and I think maybe that might have a little bit to do with the light bulb where you get your money, you're in the NBA, then all of a sudden you realize, hey, this is about my career and my legacy, right?
Yeah, and I think that's something that he's focused on. This is a guy who genuinely loves basketball. He wants to go down as one of the greatest players ever. But you can't do that when you're missing games. You can't do that when you're not competing as hard as you can night in, night out. And look, when they come into the league, a lot of these guys are 18. I was an idiot at 18. I didn't know what I was doing, and it takes a little while for it to kick in. Don't forget, he also had a child during the season last year. That probably creates some maturity for him, too, and he's kind of maybe just grown into himself. LeBron James, you know, who's playing into his 40s here, wasn't doing everything that he needed to do that year one, two, or three in the league. It even took him a little bit longer to kind of figure it out. Tom Brady's a good example of that, too. He was able to really elongate his career by the way he took care of his body, but he figured that out a little bit later. And Zion has finally figured it out. Better late than never, I say, when it comes to that sort of thing. And that should have him primed for a really big year.
Did Zion have a boy or a girl? I'm just curious.
I can't remember what it was. And he's pretty private about that sort of thing, so we don't really try and pry when it comes to it. But you've seen that. They have a child, and they start to mature really quickly.
Tim tells me it was a girl. I was wondering about some kind of, you know, Zion and, well, I hate to say little Zion because Lord knows he wouldn't be little, but, you know, some kind of Zion and his son playing, but there's still time for that. Real quick, Brandon Ingram, how do you see that playing out?
You know, right now he's going to be on the roster on opening night. That Trey Murphy extension, I don't want to say it means he's for sure going to be gone, but it definitely puts the Pelicans in a numbers issue, a numbers crunch when it comes to the salary cap next season. They're still trying to figure that out. I think it's definitely more likely than not that he won't be on the team next season, but I could see him being on the team all year long this year.
Real quick, reasonable expectation, Jake Madison. You know, optimism is high at this time of year, tipping off against the Bulls tomorrow night in Smoothie King Center. Well, what are your reasonable expectations for the Pels this season?
You know, I think if you're looking kind of for like a realistic best-case scenario, we're not going to say they're going to go 82-0, they're not going to win the title. Mm-hmm. I don't even necessarily see them making conference finals or being a final team in the NBA. There's enough talent here, even if at times the fit is questionable, that I see them being a playoff seed. They should try and at least aim for that sixth seed, get out of the play-in tournament, safely be in the postseason. There's enough talent here, even in a brutal Western Conference, to be able to do that. I think that's the realistic goal for the team this year.
All right, let me zoom ahead to summer. What would you look back and consider a successful season?
You know, I think making some noise in the playoffs. You don't have to win a first-round series, but you need to just get Zion Williamson in there, and he needs to play. They've made the playoffs two times since he's been on the roster, and he has not played in the postseason once. You've got to get him that experience, put him on the biggest stage. We saw a brief glimpse of it, that play-in tournament game against the Los Angeles Lakers in the Smoothie King Center. They were down 18 points, and he led that kind of a one-man comeback. He was putting up 40 points. He was leading them to the win. The Lakers were on the ropes. And then he suffered a hamstring injury and couldn't finish out the game, and the Lakers won.
he was going to lead the team to a win, and that I'm pretty convinced of that. We need to see that Zion Williamson in the playoffs. If you do that, even if you lose that first-round series, that provides so much optimism and something that you feel is a core building block for this franchise. You've got to get Zion Williamson in the playoffs this year.
Advancing would be nice, though. Thank you, Jake Madison, host of Locked On Pelicans. They tip it off tomorrow night against Chicago Bulls Smoothie King Center. Pels versus Bulls, game time, pregame 6:30, tip-off 7 o'clock, WWL AM FM, WWL.com, and streaming on a live Odyssey app. Tommy Tucker back in a flash, WWL. It is 9:28. We care about mental health here in the morning, and we always try to address that every couple of weeks. And we join our friend Dr. Judy Ho, clinical and forensic neuropsychologist, host of the Supercharged Life podcast, author of numerous books. You've seen her on television, I'm sure, at one point or the other. How you doing, Dr. Judy?
Hey, Tommy. Good. How are you?
I will be so happy when the election is over. I'm just, you know, man.
You burnout, election burnout.
Are you?
It's a lot, huh?
Yeah, it
yes,
is.
Yes, I am. You know, I'm going to vote by mail. I've already filled out my ballot. I'm going to take it to the mailbox today, because that's just like one thing off my mind, you know?
Yep.
And
same with me. I'm
I
an early,
definitely hear you.
Early vote. I'm early vote to get it over with.
Early
so,
vote.
So who are you voting
early
for?
Early vote.
Who
exactly.
Are you voting for? I'm just kidding. No, I'm just teasing. But first of all, since I did start that way, let's begin there as we talk about family relations and friendships and election season and everything. Who somebody votes for is absolutely none of your business.
Right.
Accurate?
Right. Yet everybody thinks that it should be your business.
Yeah.
I mean, it's so hard. I was excited when I saw that we were going to talk about this topic today, only because it is so relevant. Because it's literally, these conversations are happening everywhere. You know, I need to learn how to turn off the notifications on my phone where in the morning I get just like all these pop-ups about the election. It's like a lot, you know, and seeing all the discontent, everybody fighting. And I think it's because it just feels so personal, you know, just your ideological beliefs. It's like when you don't agree with somebody, it's like they think that you're attacking them, you know. But it doesn't have to get that personal, and yet it does, because it aligns so much with people's values. It's like a really important part of who people are, and they identify themselves with it.
Talk about, if you will, Dr. Judy, maintaining the peace in a relationship between significant others, husband, wife, husband, husband, wife, whatever, and respecting each other's right to disagree politically and not having to disclose to them. You know, you don't want secrets between couples, but there are some things that people are allowed to keep to themselves, right?
Exactly. And I think that's part of the issue when we are with close family members, friends, is part of the way that these conversations go is that even if you don't want to admit it to yourself, generally there's at least one person who's trying to get you to come to their side. You know, they want you to agree with them. And it's like, if they don't accomplish that, then they feel like they failed somehow and like this wasn't a good conversation. But I think we need to take a step back. And if we're going to have these conversations, even with people who we're in close relationship with, instead of trying to convince them to change their minds, which honestly, they're just not going to, right? 99% of the time, they've thought about their beliefs long and hard, and that's why they're their beliefs. But it's more about seeking to understand, because I think so the human mind is always trying to categorize. It's always like a us versus them type of a thing, right? And sometimes it can go okay. And other times, you know, it can really sow discontent. It can make you feel really bad about yourself. And so I think that instead of attacking the other side and making assumptions about why they might have the beliefs that they do, if you have a conversation with an attitude of curiosity and you're just like, well, okay, tell me a little bit more about why you think that way or why you support this candidate, but you're not trying to find holes in their argument. You're just trying to understand them. I think that actually improves relationships because they may support the candidate for reasons that you don't even know. And maybe there's something that you're not seeing, and then you don't have to assume, well, this person is just stupid. How could they think this? You know, this is what happens sometimes when we have these conversations, that we make a lot of assumptions that aren't true.
What I think is so sad about this is that friendships get destroyed, families break up, relationships get destroyed, when, in my opinion, Dr. Judy, they're all full of crap. The politicians is what I'm saying. They're all full of crap. And then you got personal
right.
relationships that suffer as a result of this. What is it about a campaign or is it about people wanting to be able to predict the future? Is it about them thinking an egocentric thinking that they think that they know what's better for everybody? What's happening within ourselves as we people that get all fired up about their candidate one way or the other? Is it really about patriotism or is it something more personal in that?
Way more personal, and you made a lot of good points. You know, people just want to win, right? People love winning. I mean, I would sure love to win the Niners aren't doing so well, but hey, you know, yeah. That's just how it is.
You're preaching to the choir on that
I
one,
know,
sister.
I was thinking about you. Yeah. I know. I was thinking about you guys. Yeah, but you know, I mean, listen, all human beings, they want to win. That's like a thing that we have a competitive spirit for the most part. And then on top of that, you know, it's not so much about the politicians. I mean, what do we know about them? Like you said, you know, there's a little bit of a smoke screen for all of them, right? There's a public persona that they're presenting that you're buying into. It's not really about the politician. It really is much more personal than that. For people, it's sort of like, look, if you don't agree with me, that means you don't love me. If you don't agree with this, it means that we have nothing to talk about because there's no way we think the same on these things that I really value. If you keep holding to your side and saying, I'm not going to change my mind, you know, people then make it about them. Oh, well, what is it about me that you won't change your mind for me, right? Everybody personalizes this. And the politicians are really just the stand-ins for whatever underlying resentment you might have towards a person, whatever conflict you may have already had in a relationship. It kind of just brings it all to the forefront, right? But then you get to use this politician as an excuse for why you're fighting when maybe there's more underlying things either from your own past or from your relationship with this person that actually needs to be addressed.
So on the surface, it might be about Donald Trump v. Kamala Harris, but really when you get right down to it, there's a lot more going on. Accurate?
Way more. Exactly. Very accurate.
Somebody texted in and said there's no way a relationship works with two different ideologies. Let me take a break. We can pick it up from there. We come back, Dr. Judy. How can a liberal and a conservative get along? I think I would rather be with somebody that disagrees with me respectfully and has a different point of view because they might be able to teach me something or enlighten me as opposed to, you know, the dreaded echo chamber that we all talk about, but instead of it be like in a house. I couldn't do that. 9:36, 24 till 10, traffic now, WWL. At 9:41, 19 till 10, please, for the love of God, don't break up a relationship. Don't break up a friendship. Don't break up anything because of this election. I hate to say nonsense, Dr. Judy. The future of the country is not nonsense. The government is not nonsense. But to think, and it goes to, you know, we always have the political conversations about people get so spun up about president. But if your garbage doesn't get picked up, call the White House and see what they can do for you. It's your city council person. And people tend to ignore what means the most to them, right? Like if you drop a pebble in a pond, the circle that's closest to them. So conversely, when it comes to knowing what's important and what's not, Don't get so revved up that you destroy something that you wish you had after the election's over. With that being said, let's talk about different ideologies coexisting, getting along, and being able to discuss things, or I hate to say fighting fairly because it makes it contentious, but being able to discuss things rationally and as grown-ups.
Right, yeah. You know, I really thought what you said right before the break was so important. We do tend to get into an echo chamber, you know, and I definitely do not want yes people around me all the time. You know, it can be hard sometimes to hear a different opinion. You would love it for everyone to agree with you because guess what? That's validating for you. It kind of builds your own self-esteem like, ha-ha, I'm right. But you know what? This is how people never grow. You know, if you just have the same people around you saying, yes, everything is great, everything is wonderful. But is it though? Is it really wonderful? So I will say that, you know, my husband and I, especially over the last few years, I feel like we've definitely diverged a bit more in our political beliefs. So I don't think we're voting to the same candidate. I actually haven't asked him who he's voting for. And I'm okay with that. You know, we've had our conversations. We've agreed to disagree. Sometimes it's gotten definitely a bit fiery. And once I decided, you know what, like, I'm going to try to listen. I'm going to try to take my own advice. And I'm going to try to talk to him and try to understand where he's coming from and why he has the belief that he does. I still don't agree with him, but I do think that I understand him more and I have more compassion for his point of view. You know, we're not breaking up our relationship over this election. So I do think it's interesting because at first I definitely had that same viewpoint of, oh man, you know, that's too bad that we don't have these same ideas. But actually, when I listen to understand, I actually realize that our values are very similar. It's just the way that we perceive the candidates representing those values, you know? And he's entitled to his own opinion.
And I'm not trying to pry into your relationship, but could there have been something besides the actual election that was underneath all of this?
I mean, I definitely think that my husband and I are both type A individuals.
Yeah.
So we tend to get, I think, in general, you know, we both have very strong points of view. So we definitely have more dissent maybe than other couples do. But I think that probably is the carry through, right? Because we're kind of used to being strong headed and like arguing with one another over certain things. I mean, it can even happen over, you know, how we want to clean up a room. So I think in terms of what's behind it, I think that was probably the starting place. It's like, oh, we're just used to getting into a debate because both of us think we know what's right and what's the best.
You know, as you said,
I had to accept that.
You said, cleaning up a room, everybody thinks they know the right way to do it, right? And Dr. Judy, look, I might still be married if I realized years ago that I didn't always know the right way to do something or this or that or the other thing. Maybe not. I don't know. But you do learn as you get older. Why does it take so much time for people to realize that they're not always right? They don't always know everything. A peek behind the curtain. When Jordan Fiegel was going to become the producer for me, one of the things I told him was, now, you know, you got to be able to tell me when I'm full of blank, right? Because I want we all need to be told that, don't we?
Yeah, we need somebody who's willing to say that to us, right? And sometimes it can, you know, make a relationship a little bit harder for that day or for that moment. But in the end, it sounds like Jordan's like, hey, but I have an opinion and I think that this might make this conversation better or this segment better. And you value those opinions.
If you can't, if you don't want somebody around you and you're not strong enough and can appreciate somebody to tell you, because we are all full of crap at some point to tell us when we are, then you're really missing out on. Go ahead, Dr. Judy, it's your thing. Talk about it.
You definitely, no. I mean, I appreciate your opinion on this because I think it's absolutely true. And that's one of the reasons why I respect you so much, Tommy, because you're not afraid to get constructive criticism. Listen, it can be a little hard to swallow at first, but usually constructive criticism makes me better. And so I welcome it, even if my ego is slightly bruised sometimes when getting it. If you can just take a step back and be like, well, what's the big picture here? And that's what I want people to think about in terms of this election. You know, what is the big picture? Is this relationship valuable to you? I mean, if it's not, then who cares, right? And then you're just arguing for argument's sake. But if the relationship is of value to you, then just take a step back and be like, is there a bigger picture here? And what am I trying to preserve? And if they've hurt your feelings, then be honest about that and have honest communication. But you can also say, you know what, it's getting too heated, so maybe we should just take a step back from these conversations. Or we can still talk about it, but let's put some ground rules in place. You know, how do we talk to each other? How do we talk to each other? What is the tone? How long do we want to talk about it? And then maybe after a big political discussion, you just want to do something lighthearted and fun with one another, you know, just to reset the relationship. But if the relationship is of value, then take that big step back and say, what am I really fighting for?
And is the larger issue here about fighting fairly? And what are some of the rules, some of the guidelines, I guess, for couples or even friends to remember if you're going to have a discussion, if you're going to, and again, I said fight. I hate to use that word because it's contentious. But if you're going to have a discussion, what are the rules going in? What should the ground rules be?
Well, I think that if you're going to have this conversation, what you need to tell each other is, look, you know, let's try to remember what we love about each other. Let's each say one thing that we appreciate about each other before we even get into this conversation. And then the ground rules, there's no personal attacks, no name calling, right? No, calling the other person stupid for having the belief that they have. And let's try to approach this with an attitude of curiosity. Let's just try to understand one another. Let's, after, you know, a little bit of a time where you've said something, let me try to paraphrase what I think I heard so that I can be accurate in understanding you. Because oftentimes those misconceptions occur in your perception of what was said. So it's important to take a break, you know, every like minute or so and say, okay, let me make sure I heard you right. You're saying you support this candidate because of A, B, and C. Is that right? And then they can say, yeah, that's right. Or they can say, no, not really. You missed this other point that I said. And then that really helps you to clear up the communication before you get resentful, before you start holding grudges. And I do think that it's helpful to try to put a time limit on it. You don't have to argue about this for 2 hours. Like, oh, let's just have a 30-minute conversation. And when that 30 minutes is up, let's go grab coffee. Let's go do something. Let's go walk around the park. Let's do something to relax and to try to remember why we like each other so much.
You know, it as we talk about this, I always tell people when they're looking for career advice, it's you got to have a target, because it's hard enough to hit a target if you're aiming at it. If you don't know what you're aiming at, God bless you trying to hit a target. So from the goal orientation standpoint, or being goal oriented, should you go into the discussion ahead of time thinking, well, okay, let's see, what am I really trying to accomplish here? Because if I'm trying to change their mind, I'm not going to do it. Or am I trying to learn more about what they're going to tell me? And if I'm not open to that, why are we even having the discussion?
Exactly. You know, I think sometimes we get into these conversations and we think that, like you said, the goal is to change people's minds. And guess what? You're not. And so if you can just let go of that expectation, everybody will be happier. And also you don't feel like a failure somehow coming out of that conversation thinking, oh man, I never get this accomplished. What's wrong with me? You beat yourself up for it. It's like, look, let's reset what the goal of the conversation is, right? Instead of one person winning, one person losing, or one person finally converting to being a Democrat or being a Republican, what if the goal was just to learn? Like, let me see if I can learn something new. And I will say that I was very resistant at first to, you know, some of what my husband was saying in terms of what his views were. But when I took a step back and I really tried to say, well, what is something that I can maybe learn? I have learned something from his perspective. You know, do I 100% agree with it? No. But do I feel like I understand him better? Yes. And that has improved our relationship.
Somebody texted in and said, you can say you think their opinion is stupid, but don't say they are stupid. I don't think that's accurate at all, because I think whenever you throw stupid in there, then automatically you're kind of insulting somebody. Is there a difference between that, or at least what the person's going to hear?
I know what they're trying to say. There's something that we say in psychology of like, hey, look, comment on the behavior, not the person, right? Like, instead of saying something like, hey, you're lazy, you know, say something like, hey, I really have a hard time with you not putting away the dishes every night. You know, like, actually comment on the behavior. I think that's what they're kind of going for. But, you know, throwing a word in of stupid, that's already a form of name calling. I remember that we used to do this, you know, my mom will say to my sister and I, like, oh, like, well, don't tell each other that you're, you know, don't tell each other that you're stupid, or no name calling. It's like, okay, fine. Like, Judy's not stupid. Judy's just acting stupid. It's like, okay, well, that's still the same thing.
Pretty much in the same territory.
Yeah, it's kind of the same. Right, exactly.
What about raising voices? It seems to me whenever the voices start to go up, then you're losing emotional control. It's becoming emotional, and that no good can come from that. Has anybody ever won anything by raising their voice or accomplished anything, really?
Well, maybe some people think they do, but you really don't, you know. And when people start raising their voice at me, I just get actually, like, opposite, really, really calm, because I can see that they're so dysregulated. So my way of trying to regulate that is just to become even more quiet. So you're really not going to get through to me that way. I mean, I'm just basically like, okay, well, let me just try to disengage, you know. So you don't want to raise your voice. It's not going to get your point across more. And then people are just going to react to what they perceive as that fieriness, right? So I think that should be a ground rule. You know, I personally really hate it when people start raising their voices in a conversation. So I'll say, okay, well, that's too much. Like, we need to take a break. And you should have a ground rule like that if you're like me. You know, like, hey, you just raise your voice. Let's just take a 5-minute reset and try to come back to this. You know, let's just check our tone, because tone is so important. Tone can really either help or hinder a conversation.
Real quick, before we let you go, to the bigger issue of, you know, the right way to clean a room or the wrong way to clean a room, because after the election is over, the rooms are still going to be there. How do you go about, right, as a couple negotiating and realizing that, you know, you're not always right about everything, even though we know my way is the best way?
I know. It takes a little bit of a humbleness to admit that. And I think that you have to just understand we all have egos. It's okay. We all do want to be right. Just admit that to yourself. Mm-hmm. That's all right. But it's just impossible for one person to be right all the time. Nobody is right all the time. So again, just release yourself of those expectations. It's okay to be wrong sometimes, because all of us are wrong sometimes.
That person that's next to you, that's going to matter more than the election. I guarantee you that. So take care of it. Thank you, Dr. Judy.
Exactly. Thank you, Tommy.
Have a good day. Dr. Judy Ho, clinical forensic neuropsychologist, host of the Supercharged Life podcast. Newell's in studio today, so we're going to see if he sees his shadow and what that means as far as the rest of the fall when we come back here on WWL.